This is an ABC podcast.
In the summer of 2013, Raina Wynn and her husband Moth lost their beloved farm in Wales, the home where they had raised their two kids and made their income. At 50 and 53, they suddenly found themselves homeless and completely broke. Then, in the same week as they lost their home, another bombshell. Moth was diagnosed with a rare degenerative brain disease. Doctors gave him maybe 2 years to live. So, Raina and Moth set off on a walk around the west coast of England, from Somerset through Devon, Cornwall to Dorset. Raina's book about that journey, The Salt Path, became a bestseller, and no one was more surprised about that than Raina. Her new book, The Wild Silence, is about what happened next. Hi, Raina.
Oh, hi, Sarah.
Take me back, Raina, to that horror week, first losing the farm. Where were you and Moth when the bailiffs came banging on the door?
Yeah, that awful week. Yes, we were under the stairs. Bailiffs were knocking at the door. It wasn't that we thought some amazing miracle was going to happen and we wouldn't have to leave our beautiful home. It was just that we weren't ready to leave. We weren't ready to take that final step over the threshold. So we hid under the stairs, hoping the bailiffs wouldn't see us and they might go away. But unfortunately, they didn't.
And after you did have to face the music there and walk out, Moth received this terrible diagnosis. Had you even ever heard of CBD, corticobasal degeneration? Have you heard of that before?
No, we hadn't. It was a complete unknown to us. And as the consultant tried to describe it to us, we just couldn't take it in. It was this neurodegenerative disease that would change Moth's life forever. And it was terminal disease with no treatment and no cure. And like you said, he gave us about 2 years of very rapidly declining health. And all he could say was, you know, just don't get too tired. Be careful on stairs. It's shocking.
Don't get too tired and be careful on stairs. So why did you set out on this extraordinarily long walk?
Yes, yeah, it was quite a long way, wasn't it? I think it was in that moment as we were under the stairs, that's what did it. There was a packing case in front of us that hadn't been taken out of the door, and on the top of it were a few books that I'd just randomly picked up as we were going out of the house. And there was a book by Mark Warrington called 500 Mile Walkies. And it was a book I'd read decades before about a young man that walked the southwest coast path of England with his dog. And just then in that awful moment, just the idea of just filling a rucksack and going for a walk just seemed like the obvious thing to do. Because we knew as soon as we went out of that door, we were going to be homeless because there was no accommodation available to us, nowhere we could stay for more than a couple of days at a time. So just the idea of just putting a rucksack on and walking seemed just like reasonable at the time.
What about your kids, Raina? Could you have stayed with them?
Well, they were both in their last year of university, so they were about to have to leave their university accommodation, their shared accommodation, which, you know, if anybody who's got teenage children would know, you wouldn't want to go in teenage student accommodation anyway. They were going to have to find their own way in the world because they just lost their home too. So they had no home to come back to when uni finished. So it was really difficult. There was just nobody who had space for us for more than a day or two at a time.
So was this long walk along the southwest coast of England more your idea than Moth's, or were you both enthusiastic about it?
I think initially it was my idea. I'd have to admit that. But then very quickly, I think Moth sort of picked up on the idea of a map. And just the fact that that map would give us a route, really, a way forwards, a reason to get up the next day. Because at that point, we'd lost just about every material thing that we had. And with that, the whole framework, the whole structure of our lives that we'd spent the previous 20 years creating, just gone. in that moment as we walked out of the door. So that map offered us a reason, really, a purpose, because we lost everything.
So you set off, Raina. Tell me, what did you carry with you as you began this walk from Somerset?
Well, in the first couple of weeks after we left our house, we did have somewhere to stay because a friend was on holiday, so we could use their house. So we took those 2 weeks to prepare, and we bought a used tent and a couple of very ultra lightweight sleeping bags from the supermarket, and what turned out to be quite a cranky old gas stove. And that was just about it. We had a change of clothes, which very quickly turned into nothing at all because the things got ripped and disappeared. And that was just about all we had.
And how careful did you have to be with money, say, for buying food and other things along the way?
Well, we had very little money. It started out as £48. I don't know what that relates to in Australia.
Not much. Sort of,
but very quickly that reduced to about £30 a week. And in the southwest, in the holiday season, when for some reason the prices all seem to rise here, it didn't go very far at all. So food was constantly a problem because we could really not afford to eat. So it was quite an issue.
So what was on the menu most days then?
Oh, don't remind me. Noodles, maybe dried noodles. Like I said, it very quickly reduced to £30, which it doesn't go very far if you've got to buy a canister of gas or maybe pay for a ferry or something. It very quickly disappeared. But very quickly, you can get really, really, really sick of noodles.
What were some of the hardest times that you remember going hungry? What were some days where you just needed something more substantial than noodles?
Oh, there were moments when the noodles ran out and we were miles away from shops, and we had a really difficult point where all we could find was a bag of fudge in a little tiny tourist shop, and we lived on a bag of fudge for 2 days. The very worst moment came when we really completely ran out of food and we woke up one morning so hungry, and all we could find was one hairy wine gum in Mott's pocket, and we cut that in half and had it for breakfast. I think that was the worst point of the hunger.
A hairy wine gum halved for breakfast. That sounds pretty dire, Raina. What about where you were camping? I mean, you couldn't really pay for campsites, so what sort of places did you end up setting your tent up?
No, we couldn't afford campsites at all, so we ended up wild camping, which is strictly quite illegal in England. So we had to find places where we were hidden away, where people couldn't see us. So we were just out on exposed headlands. We were on beaches. We were in woodlands. We were just in every remote corner that we could find. And often we wouldn't put the tent up until it was virtually dark, just so that everybody had gone and nobody would see us putting it up. So it was strange to find often in the mornings that you would wake up in a different place to where you thought you'd put the tent. So sometimes we woke in a field full of thistles that had punctured the fly sheet, or on an overhang of a cliff that was about to give way. But then there were other like really magical points where we woke up on those mornings and we were in a little field full of ladybirds hatching into their first flight. Or another morning on a foggy headland and just listening to the seals calling in the coves below as the light started to lift and expose the headlands one by one. So there were real plus points to the wild camping, as well as those real precarious moments as well.
And what about the weather? How wild did that get?
Well, it's Britain after all. So we were expecting wild, wet, windy weather because that's the British summer. But actually, that was one of those rare summers where it didn't rain. The heat climbed to temperatures we don't often see here. And it was really hot just when we were in the area of the walk where there was no shelter and no trees. And we were running out of water rather than sheltering from it for a lot of the time, but then the weather broke and it turned into typical British weather of horizontal rain and gale and just dreadful weather. So it really went from one extreme to another.
And Raina, how did people react when you and Moth said you were on this walk because you were homeless?
Well, yeah, that was a difficult point because we'd lived in a very rural place, so we hadn't really encountered homelessness. It wasn't something that we'd thought about, really. Certainly hadn't thought about the reactions of other people to us when we told them. So as we started walking, we'd just stop and chat to people, and they would say, "How come you've got so much time to walk so far?" We replied quite, you know, quite honestly, and said, "Well, we've lost our house and we've got nowhere to go, so we're just walking." And people would actually physically recoil, you know, draw their dogs in on the retractable leads or gather their children. And it came as such a shock to us that people actually would react to homelessness in that way. And I think we hit up one of our very lowest points, surrounded the reaction of people, really. We were outside a shop just a very short time into the walk, really, but we were already very short of money. And we were standing outside a shop just counting the last few coins that we had, just counting them in my hand. And a lady came past us with this huge white dog that caught my rucksack and sent the coins flying out of my hand. Well, they fell onto the pavement and they were rolling down the hill. So I was straight down on the ground, hand down the drainage grill, trying to catch those coins. And the woman started poking me with her foot, saying, "You know, we don't have people like you here. Get up. We don't have drunken tramps in the street." As I was lying there on the pavement, asking who she's talking to, because it can't be me. And then as I realised it actually was, I think that's the point where that sense of self, that sense of who I was, you know, not just in a wider society, but sort of in my own life, really, it just started to disintegrate. So from then on, when people said, you know, "How come you've got so much time to walk so far?" We started to say, "Oh, well, it's because we've sold our house. We're just having a midlife moment and going where the wind blows." And then the reaction would be so different. So that difference between lost your house and sold your house, yeah, came as quite a surprise.
Mm. Did you encounter other people who were in a similar situation to you, who were there on the path because they were homeless?
Yes, we did, and that was unexpected, for sure. People who were living in cars and under bridges, people living in communities, in sheds and horse boxes, and all living as a camped community in a wood. It was really surprising to find that there were so many people, but normally in the countryside you just don't see. But obviously, because they keep themselves hidden away in these areas of higher house prices and tourism and holidays, and yes, they're there, we just don't see them.
What did all this walking and being out in the elements, what did that mean for Moth's health, given that doctors had warned you against doing anything too tiring and avoiding walking upstairs? How was he coping?
Well, that's right. Like I said, they only said maybe 2 years. So we thought we were just seizing a last moment of good health, really. But as we'd walked for a few weeks and really probably about 200 miles, I would think, we started to realise that he was becoming a little bit more sure on his feet and a little bit easier with his rucksack. But I don't think we really realised how much his health was improving until it was the end of a really, well, a really perfect summer's day. And we went down to a beach and the sea was like treacle. It was so smooth and flat. And we went out and swam in the bay and dolphins came in. And it would have been a perfect day, you know, had we not been homeless and Moth was dying. It would have been, but we pitched a tent just well above the high tide line, and we thought we'd spend the night there because it had been such a beautiful spot. But then at 3 a.m. we realised we weren't above the high tide line at all, because I opened the tent flaps and the sea was about a metre away from the tent and still rising. So we had to get out of the tent, and we shoved our rucksacks on and jumped out of the tent and picked the whole thing up whole, still fully erected, and ran up the beach with it above our heads, carrying it above our heads, this big dome of tent. We splashed through the water and got higher up the beach and dropped the tent down at the foot of the cliffs. We realised that Moth had just run up the beach. He'd run up the beach holding a tent above his head from having been barely able to put his coat on without help when we started that walk. He'd just run up the beach holding a tent above his head. It felt like a miracle.
And what did he put that down to at the time?
We thought it must just be just time spent walking. We couldn't put it down to anything else, really, because we couldn't say what it could be, other than that maybe some sort of extreme physio had had some real positive effect on him.
Did you let yourself, I don't know, think that maybe the future was going to be different than what those doctors had told you?
We almost didn't let that thought in. It's as if we couldn't dare to hope until maybe we got to Land's End, which is right at the very end, as it says, the most westerly point in England. And it felt like such a turning point on the path, but in ourselves as well. It was one of those real Cornish days of horizontal rain and battering winds. It was a horrendous day, and we got to the Land's End building, which is quite a concrete monstrosity, really, and it's normally heaving with people. But there was not a soul there that day. It was just nobody. But we walked through there, beyond there, onto these huge, blocky granite cliffs that are right at the very edge of the Atlantic. And just standing there at the very end of the land where the sea comes battering in and bringing all the weather systems that come across the Atlantic from, well, Canada, I suppose, on the other side. And it should have been, probably, as we looked in our pockets and there was only a Mars bar and £2.50 left, it should have been one of the lowest points of our lives, really. But I think we realised that actually it wasn't. It was actually the opposite. Because what we had at that moment was we'd started to feel a sense of hope that we thought we'd never feel again. And that path was giving us a life, really, when we thought ours was completely over. And, yeah, in that moment, I think we started to realise something really quite special that we couldn't identify at the time, but we knew it was something important to us.
How long did it take you to finish the South Coast Walk?
To walk the entire thing, it was about 100 days.
100 days, that is a serious amount of walking. Where did you find to live then, Raina, after finishing it? You didn't really have any plans beyond that walk. What did you decide to do next?
Towards the end of that walk, Moth had thought that maybe if he started to maybe retrain, then maybe we could, for some sort of employment, maybe we could find a way forwards into the future. And he decided he would like to go to university. So he applied for a university place and was accepted. So we knew that he had this place eventually at the end of that following year from when we first started the walk. So this was a whole year later. And we were walking towards that point where he would start university, but still with no accommodation, thinking that we would be living in the tent as he went to university. And we met somebody in a cafe where we'd gone in to see if we could get some hot water, and started talking to this woman. And we told her our story, and we were just chatting. And she said, actually, I've got a flat, and it's in the village where you've said you're going to end your walk. Would you like it? And we were overwhelmed by the idea that somebody had just offered us accommodation, because we hadn't been able to rent anywhere, because having lost our house in the way we did, it had left such a trace on our credit record that meant that nobody would give us a property to rent, because we didn't look like a viable tenant. But she was offering us somewhere no questions asked, just go and live there. And it was unbelievable.
So this was in a little flat in a Cornish village at the back of a chapel, an old chapel. Did it feel very luxurious to you, Raina, to have, you know, four walls and a roof again? How did you sleep at night when you first arrived?
Oh, it was incredible to go back in the house and to go back under a roof. And I thought it would be so perfect and so wonderful and so easy. But we went in and there was something about going back indoors. I couldn't settle. I couldn't sleep. I just felt constantly agitated and restless. And I didn't know why and I couldn't understand it either. So I couldn't sleep, and I was finding that I was awake in the night and going out onto the coastal headlands, because this house was right on the coast path. I was going out onto the headlands in the night sometimes because I just couldn't sleep. Even sleeping in the gorse bushes, it became quite ridiculous, really, until the point where we suddenly thought, it's about the tent. And I got the tent out and put the tent up in the bedroom. I don't feel good. The sleeping bag, and it was still full of sand, and as I got back in it straight to sleep, I knew then I'd got a bit of a problem.
Well, a problem that you were able to solve by putting your tent up. Now, Moth's health, as you say, had really rallied on that long walk. How was it affected by being in a more settled, theoretically more comfortable situation?
Well, yes, he started his degree course, but of course all that studying meant that he was quite sedentary. We'd walk as much as we could every day, but there wasn't really time for it. So his health, it started to decline really quickly. Within just a few months, his health dropped below the point it was at when we started the walk. And with that drop in his physical health, his memory was starting to fade as well. It was really strange because on one hand he was learning because he was at university and he was doing his university work, but then he was starting to forget things. He was starting to forget our walk, actually, forget a lot of the things that had happened to us as we were walking. And it was a really difficult time for his health.
There was one memory in particular, one event that kind of broke your heart when he couldn't remember. Tell me about the blackberries.
Yeah, it was as if he hadn't remembered it at all. And it was such a special moment to me. It was another wet morning, and we were walking along a coast path, and we saw two old gentlemen coming up from a cove below. One of them fully dressed, hat, coat, gloves, the whole lot, and the other one in bathers and flip-flops, carrying a Tupperware box. And as they got closer to us, I could see that Tupperware box held blackberries. It was full of blackberries. Well, we'd eaten blackberries as we'd walked along, but they hadn't been very nice. They'd been sort of tart and sharp and really unpleasant. So when he offered me one, I hadn't wanted to take it because of that horrible experience we'd had with blackberries. But as I bit into it, because I took one just to be polite, I bit into it, and it was the most perfect purple autumnal flavour you can imagine. And I said, you know, what is this? Is this some rare species down in the cove below? What is this thing? And he said, no, this is something. This is something so special. When the mist comes in and lays a layer of salt on a perfectly ripe blackberry, what you get is something that chefs can't create and money can't buy. It's a gift of time and nature. And I held on to that as we walked. And afterwards as well, I'd held on to that idea of that's what our walk was for us. It was like that blackberry. It was a gift of time and nature. It had felt so special to us. And I just held on to that idea. So when Moth said that he couldn't really remember it, it felt devastating to me, because I thought, if he's lost that incredibly special moment, then how much more of our time on that path and our time together was he losing? It was quite frightening to acknowledge that.
podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So is that why you started writing, Raina, writing the book that was eventually published as The Salt Path, to help Moth remember?
It was then that I started to think about maybe trying to capture that walk for him. And I got the guidebook out that we'd used for that walk. It was just a little plastic covered brown guidebook written by Paddy Dillon that we'd used on that whole walk. And as I opened it, all the pages were crinkled like the beach when the tide's gone out. And inside there were feathers and bits of paper and all sorts of little mementos that we'd picked up as we'd walked. But in the margins, alongside Paddy's incredible descriptions of the path, in the margins were penciled notes that every night in the tent Moth had just jotted down in the margin there, you know, where we'd camped or somebody we might have met. And those penciled notes were starting to fade. And as I looked at that guidebook, it was like those penciled notes were fading like Moth's memories. And I thought, I'm going to have to try to capture them, to keep them for him somehow. So I started to write up the penciled notes just as they were. But when I looked back at what I'd written, somehow the path wasn't there, our experience wasn't there. It was just a series of notes that didn't mean anything. And then I looked at them again, and when I looked at them alongside Paddy's descriptions and alongside this OS map that runs right through the book of the whole of the path, suddenly then I could feel the path, then I could smell the salt, and I could hear the gulls. And I started to write it down as a narrative. And I was writing it for Moth so that when he read it, he was right there on the path next to me. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to describe that path and our experience of that path so that he would feel it. He would feel it too. And before I knew it, I was writing a book.
Take me back further in your time together, right back to when you met one another. Where were you? How old were you when you first met Moth?
Oh, Sarah, that's a long way back. Yeah, so we go back to when I was 18, and I was sitting in the college canteen, and it was a really busy canteen, and it was really full that day. But as I looked up, there was this parting in the heads between the people in the room, and right on the other side of the room, I could see this young man in this white shirt with, even from that distance, I could see with these dazzling blue eyes. But it wasn't that that attracted me to him. I just watched as he dipped a Mars bar in a cup of tea. And I thought, you know, there's just something about that. He's me.
The mysterious ways of love, the way he dipped his Mars bar in a cup of tea. And what was, once you got to know him, what besides Mars bars was he passionate about? What kind of young man was Moth?
Well, We shared something, and it was something quite unexpected, really, because I'd grown up on a farm, so lived a very, very rural life. My whole existence really had been sort of around the seasons, around the farming seasons. But then I met Moth, and although he'd grown up on the edge of a town, he had a real passion for the outdoors, for the natural world. And he was really drawn to the wild spaces, to the mountains, to the edge, to the wild spaces in the country. That was where we bonded, was over that real love and passion for the natural world. And that's what we spent our first years doing, was really together just exploring the wild places.
What did your parents think of him?
Well, they were horrified because, of course, he wasn't a farmer, so he didn't have any acres. As far as they were concerned, he might well love nature, but he didn't have the acres, so he just wouldn't do. And it became a really, really difficult time in our lives of me being torn between Moth and my parents, and a lot of sneaking about. It was very difficult years.
What kind of childhood had it been for you on the farm, Raina? Were you a solitary kind of kid?
I was. I spent most of my time alone in the fields, in the woods, just alone, just being, really. I spent time just watching wild animals, and, you know, watching a rabbit or in the ditch feeding the water voles. And that was the childhood I had.
Where was your favourite place to go on the farm?
Yeah, there was this huge willow tree that hung, the branches hung down rather than up, but came down. And every summer those tendrils of the willow tree hung right down to the ground. And I had this thing as a child that I would run to those tendrils and grab a handful and swing. And if I ran fast enough and swung hard enough, it would take me up into the branches of the tree. And I would sit in there, and it would be in this dome of branches where nobody knew where I was. And I could just sit and observe the adults and just be in the green, this strange rustling green canopy. And I did spend many, many hours of my childhood up that tree. But every summer, after my mum discovered where I was, the tree was trimmed, so it was out of my reach. But by the end of the summer holidays, it had always grown down to the ground again, just allowed me back up into its branches. So, yeah.
One night when you were seven or so, your dad woke you up. What did he want to show you?
That was such an unbelievable night, really. My dad, not just for the fact that my dad woke me up in the middle of the night to go outside, which was unheard of. And he said, I've got to show you this because you may never see this again. And we went into the field, and there was this tree that had stood alone in the field, in the middle of the field, this huge old elm tree. Massive tree that the cows used to shelter under on summer's days. And it was completely aflame, just this one tree completely burning, like a huge column of fire in the middle of the field. And I was saying, Dad, I remember it so distinctly, why is it burning? He said, I haven't. It's as if it's just ignited itself. And we stood and watched it there in the night, as this tree just finally cracked and fell to the ground and just burnt out its last of its life force into this sparking energy in the sky. And I saw something in my dad's face then that I'd never seen in that farming, weather-worn, pragmatic face before. And it was a real sense of awe and wonder at something so terrible but so magnificent at the same time, that it really struck something in me of that's what the natural world was, something to be in awe of, really. It was a memory of my dad that I would never forget.
And out of that shared awe for the natural world that you found in Moth when you were a young woman, and after these difficult years of hiding around and dealing with your mum and dad's unhappiness that you'd fallen in love with someone who didn't have a farm, you decided to get married. Where was your wedding?
So we decided we were going to get married, and obviously that wouldn't be something that my parents were going to be happy with. So we booked a registry office on a Scottish island, the Isle of Skye, and we caught the train and went to the island, and got our clothes that we'd smuggled up in our rucksacks out, and the registry office had been closed down for repairs, so they'd made a makeshift temporary office at the back of the builders merchants. So it was just this tiny little office that was full of dust and builders equipment and all sorts of things at the back of the builders merchants, with a Hessian sack covering the doorway through to the where they sold all their hardware. And as the registrar was saying, do you take this man? Somebody on the other side of the Hessian sack was, and can I have half a pound of lost heads, please? it was quite, came out thinking, that was an interesting experience, but have we been?
you say you got married up in Scotland, and Moth in particular had always loved exploring those wild Scottish mountains, and you'd originally thought that that's where you'd look for a home to bring up your kids. How did you end up in Wales instead?
Oh, it was a traffic jam. We were heading to Scotland on another trip to try and maybe find somewhere to bring up the children in the sort of place that we'd thought we would live. And there was this incredible traffic jam that just went on for hours and hours. And if you've ever been trapped in a van with two tiny children for hours, it's not good for your health.
All sorts of decisions are made out of those experiences.
Yeah, so we took a turn off the motorway just to get out of the traffic, and that took us into Wales. And we went into Wales, and we went to the coast, and we'd never really explored that part of the country before. Moth certainly hadn't at all. And it was stunning, it was beautiful, and somehow in that random turn off the motorway, it came to be the place that we found a house. We found the place we wanted to live, and it became home for the next 20 years.
And what was special about the farm that you found there, Raina? What did you love about it?
It was beautiful. It was just nestled in the base of the hills, half a mile off the road, with no neighbours, and it was just what we'd been looking for, a place that we could restore, that we could afford, and it was all of those things, but it really was in a dreadful state, because there were holes in the walls and the roof was falling in, but it was exactly what we'd been looking for, so we bought it and we started repairing it. Years repairing it, really.
So you spent two decades there until that terrible morning when the bailiffs came knocking on the door. How did you end up living in a farm again after you'd finished your walk?
Yeah, well, I've got to say, I never thought that I would find myself back on a farm. It came as a surprise to me that it happened, that's for sure. After the book The Salt Path was published, the publishers said, well, we need you to do social media, because that will help promote the book. So I signed up to Twitter, having no idea what to do with it. So when somebody asked me for my phone number, I just gave them it. And maybe I wouldn't do that now, but at the time it seemed reasonable. But then this person got in touch with me, and it was somebody who'd read The Salt Path and who connected so personally with the story that they really just felt they had to talk to us. And it was someone who owned an old cider farm just a few miles away from where we were living. And it was a place that had been neglected and overused, agriculturally really overused, and seriously neglected for a few years. And he said, but I've got this dream that we can return the biodiversity and bring the wildlife back to the farm. And I've read your book, and I think you're the ones to help me do that, to help me make that dream a reality. And we couldn't believe it. It was an unbelievable offer. But how could we do it? How could we trust somebody again after the trust that had been betrayed and had led to us losing the house? And then after the reactions that we'd received from people on the path that had sort of made us stop trusting people altogether. How could we ever recover that trust enough to take up his offer? So it was quite a conundrum.
What were your first impressions when you visited that farm that was being offered to you? What did it look like?
A mess. The farm itself it was just covered in every form of agricultural detritus you can think of. The land was just eaten away. The hedges were eaten into. Everything felt as if everything had been taken from it and nothing put back. But the house itself, goodness, the house hadn't been lived in for a while. And when we came in, it was just incredibly damp, very Cornish house, in that it sort of sucks up the moisture, sucks up all the moisture. And then when it stops raining, it sort of like oozes out again. So a very, very damp house. It was a bit like a sponge, really, and full of mice.
So it was obviously going to be a huge amount of work, and you'd had this feeling that could you really trust an offer like this? You'd been pretty badly burnt. What made you say yes? Why did you and Moth decide to take this risk and take on another huge project?
I think it was because Moth's health had declined so much during that time when he'd been working on his degree, that we knew that he needed to be physically outside, active in the outdoors as much as possible. And if we couldn't find a place where he could be active outside in nature, then we would have to put our rucksacks on again and walk, because we had to find some way to see his health improve again in the way it had before, because if not, we weren't far away from it becoming too late for us to do anything. And so just the idea of being back in the natural world on a day-to-day basis and living, you know, as part of the natural world again, That seemed almost too obvious to us as being something that we needed. But then we went back to the house and just to have one more look, and it was getting dark and we were just about to close the door. And in front of the house, this deer jumped out of a hedge and walked in front of the house. It's a beautiful little roe deer. And just looked around and then disappeared into what then was like shoulder-high weeds and nettles. And just in that moment, just watching that deer walk across, we realised that actually that was a really magical place and that we had to go. And so we just held hands and took a huge jump, a huge leap of faith.
And after taking that leap and beginning to work on the farm and restoring it to health and restoring the farmhouse, what changes have you seen? What, for example, what birds have come back?
Yeah, when we first came, there was hardly any wildlife here, hardly anything at all. There were a few sparrows and a couple of crows that lived in the trees, but that was about it. But this summer, as we've been here for these few months when we've all been shut in, we've watched as so much bird life has come back to the place. There have been goldfinches and blue tits and wrens and blackcaps and all sorts of migratory birds that have come and nested here that we certainly weren't here when we first came. And the swallows and the house martins, and then a barn owl has moved in. It's just so magical to watch the barn owl every evening at dusk, because it just flies through. It's so white, such a brilliant thing to watch.
And what about Moth's health, Raina? Did it have the effect you were hoping it would, being back in nature and involved in physical labour again?
Well, strangely, yes, it has. He's not as well as he was when we were walking, but his health has improved incredibly. And at the moment, we feel like we're on some sort of plateau with his health. In a way, I think what's happening to the farm, to the land, to the wildlife, it almost mirrors what's happening with Moth's health. It's as if we've sort of taken the heavy human intervention from the farm, stepped back a little bit from it, and the wildlife is coming back, the biodiversity is coming back. It's as if nature is regenerating itself It doesn't need us to do it. It just needs us to step away from it. And it's the same with Moth's health, really. By putting him back into a more natural state of being physically active and outdoors in the natural world, his health is improving in ways that the doctors can't quantify, they can't qualify. And yet it is tangibly physically happening. So there's something to be drawn from that, I think.
This farm that you're living on in Cornwall is an ancient cider-making farm. What do the apple trees look like?
Well, the older apple trees have been there for a very long time. This farm sort of grew from being a farm that supplied a priory where the monks were down on the creek below us. And it's been producing cider here ever since then, which is around 800 years ago. So it's a long, long history of cider production. And the apples get old, they're gnarled, they're twisted, the branches bend down to the ground. And there's a sense of age and time in those trees that takes you back as you walk into the orchard, back into another time. You could almost feel the monks picking the apples.
What do they taste like?
Such a variety of apples. There are some that are cider apples that are obviously unedible because they're cider apples. But then there are others that are culinary apples, and there are huge apples that are the size of small footballs, and then there are tiny, sweet, little bright red apples. There are apples, varieties that are long gone, but they're still here in this orchard. Apples like Cornish Maid and Cornish Aromatic and Tom Put and Pig Snout, and names that you can just get lost in the romance of the names. Yeah.
How did things go with your first apple harvest?
Yeah, so the first apple harvest we had to do quite quickly because we had an incredible storm that blew all the apples off the trees, and they were all on the ground starting to rot. So we had to muster up all the friends that we had who came and helped us pick them. So it was all done in a bit of a hurry, and it was our first experience of pressing apples for cider. So maybe not the most marketable cider I've ever drunk, that's for sure.
That must have been a significant moment for you, not just the harvest itself, but that there was a group of other humans you could call on, that you had support, you had help when you needed it.
Absolutely. And these were the people from the village in Cornwall, the place where we'd first found the accommodation when we'd stopped walking. People that I'd hidden from because I was so withdrawn from people and from living as part of a community. And yet by the time we left, people who'd become our friends and who didn't need asking, who just came and brought people we didn't know, people who just came to help. And it was remarkable to find that actually I could start to trust people again, that I could actually start to believe in people again. So it was good to know.
Raina, I love to think of you there with your barn owl and your cider apples and you and Moth together. I wish you all the best for this next stage. Thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah. It's been lovely to talk to you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey, I'm Pat Abbott, lead reporter on a new ABC podcast called Days Like These. Hot tip, if you're looking for more great human stories, each week, Days Like These introduces you to one regular human as they live through something wild. From the heartbreaking to the hilarious, the serious to the strange, you'll hear classic Aussie stories with humour, curiosity, and bucket loads of empathy. Think of the show as the antidote to all that's overwhelmed us in 2020. Jump on your ABC Listen app or Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe to Days Like These so you don't miss out. New apps drop every Wednesday.